crying here talking about the ending of La La Land. Like, get a grip.
Me too, girl. I gotta go too. I gotta go see Ryan Gosling.
It's amazing. It's crazy.
To see them reunite in this way, I feel like was one, fan service, and two, everything that I ever wanted.
Da, 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 da.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Off to Broadway, the podcast where we deep dive into anything and everything musical theater from the comfort of my car. I'm Tara.
I'm Stefania.
And in today's episode, we're back with another movie musical, or is it a movie musical? We'll get into that later. And today, we're talking about La La Land. I feel like this is a movie that when we first saw it, we did not see this together, but when we first saw it, it was like, oh, like, eventually, somewhere down the line, like, I need to have a full discussion of my thoughts and feelings on this movie, and today is the day.
Today is that day. We've come here. I've rewatched La La Land. I saw it twice in theaters when it came out, the year it came out, and I honestly love this movie. It makes me very happy to watch it every time.
Mm-hmm. I saw this movie also twice in theaters. The first time I saw it was actually at the Toronto International Film Festival the year that it premiered here. And I had seen it after it had won Audience Choice at TIFF in 2016 at the Winter Garden. And I was saying to you before we started recording that, like, just walking into that building, knowing that I was going to see, like, this movie with two actors that I already loved was enough to make me, like, excited to see it. And then actually seeing it on the big screen, which was literally just like pulled down projector kind of screen at Winter Garden, because, you know, yeah, a theater for live things, not for movies. And the way that the movie opens in like CinemaScope and then comes into the full screen, it just was like a whole full experience. And as soon as I saw it that time, I was like, oh, I need to watch this again and again and again. And I've seen it so many times since it has come out in 2016 and most recently last night.
Yeah, very recently. This is kind of one, it's just a movie I feel that you can put on and just enjoy because it's very much, to me, told through music and told not even through words many times. It like transcends language. It transcends so many things. It gets its point across very, very visually, so you don't have to be paying attention to every minute thing or every plot point, because it's a very simple overarching story that is told through music and through visuals and not so much through like specific words and statements. So it's a great one. You can just pick it up at any time. It's just such a feel-good movie.
Yeah. So a brief synopsis of La La Land is that we follow our two main characters, Sebastian and Mia. Sebastian is, I would say, a struggling jazz artist, and Mia is a struggling young actress, and they both live in Los Angeles, and you kind of like follow their individual stories, which again, I think this is something that we'll get into when we talk a bit about like the shooting style of this movie. It's very interesting how they do this and show the relationship between this couple. And yeah, like in terms of what actually happens, not that much happens. We just like follow along with their lives, which is maybe why it's such an enjoyable movie. And then we get to the end where, like, there are many possibilities of, like, what could actually happen, what you think happens, what actually happens, and then, like, are you happy with the ending? So we'll get into all of that a lot later, but
It's a tale as told as time. It's a tale as old as time. It doesn't need plot twists. It's just, it's star-crossed lovers. It is the same story told over and over and over again to people who are in love, but the timing is not right. And they don't end up together, but they love each other. There's like a million movies about this, but this one is there. It's a story that hits every time, that emotionally gets the audience every time. So you have that very simple structure, and then the music, the set, what Damien Chazelle that did to build out from that story is what makes this movie special.
So I think we should get into it before we dive in any further and discuss and potentially debate, is La La Land a musical? What do you think?
I think at the barest definition, I do think it is a musical. But I think it falls into the traps or the faults that many movie musicals have. The biggest one I find is that it kind of runs out of songs by the end. Mm-hmm. I think I find a lot of movie musicals run out of music by the end. They have the Dream Ballet at the end, but before that, you're kind of like, you're going really long, extended periods of times without singing. So it kind of, a lot of its story is not told through music, but right. I do think it is a musical. What do you think, Tara?
I also would say that it's a musical. And I also would go as far to say that it might be one of the better movie musicals in the last however many years. I don't think that's because the music is like above some of the other movie that's musicals fine. That have come out, but like the overall style, the acting, just like the overall picture of it to me is a very good movie musical. I agree. We do run out of songs very early in this movie. I actually was researching this, and out of the 2 hours and 7 minutes, there is only 23 minutes of music. So in that sense, you'd be like,
there's a lot of score, though. There's a lot of score, but
tons of score. Yeah. I think like if I pull up the track list right now, in terms of like our two leads actually singing, I mean, Another Day of Sun is a classic opening number. Again, we will talk about all of these songs as we continue to go through, but just to like count them. Another Day of Sun, like Someone in the Crowd, theme I would say counts, even though no one actually sings on it. But it, to me, the theme is one of the reasons why I believe that this is a musical. A Lovely Night, City of Stars Again, Start a Fire, Audition. So seven songs in this 2 hour movie. So
two of them are the same. And two of them are
exactly. There's like a reprise, even though it's not even called a reprise. But to me, when I was looking up, like, this is a debate over critics when this movie came out. Like, is this considered a movie musical? I mean, at the Golden Globes, it was obviously put in the like comedy musical category. Yeah. But yeah, I think for me, what like set it over the edge is that theming. Sebastian and Mia's theme. Shows up throughout the entire movie, basically from the first scene, like not the exact first scene, but like we are there for 2 hours. It's just simple piano, but it's something that sticks with you the entire time, and he plays it all the time, and it helps them transition with whose story we're following at one point. So it's very smart.
So much of the story is told just with those like few piano keys. That's what I'm talking about with you don't need dialogue between these characters. Half, like the majority of the story is just told through those piano keys, and sometimes it sounds sad and sometimes it sounds happy and sometimes it's grand and sweeping and sometimes it's quiet, and it's just like the same notes over and over again. Like when Mia, I think, hears it when she's out to dinner with her boyfriend or whoever.
And yes, I love that scene.
There's no dialogue, but you're on the same page as Mia immediately, and you know she's going to run and go see Sebastian at the movie that she stood him up at.
She hears those, like, three notes and looks around and looks at her boyfriend, and she's like, I'm sorry, I have to go. And it's like, me too, girl. I got to go, too. I got to go see Ryan Gosling. I got to
see Ryan at the movies at 10 p.m. Who has a date at 10 p.m.?
At the Rialto. What was he seeing? It was a classic.
Rebel. Was it, like, Rebel Without a Cause? I think so.
Yeah. A movie I haven't seen either, Mia. Like, same girl. We're the same. So, yeah, I think for that reason, it is a musical to me. And also something that we were talking about without actually talking about if it's a musical or not before we came on here was, you know, like, the characters emote and you feel those emotions with them. And there are certain, like, dream sequence scenes. And I just don't think you could do that with the music and the singing and not call it a movie musical, in my opinion.
Yes, I agree. This movie is told through music. Not the same, but another movie that's not a movie musical, but another movie I think is told through music is something like A Baby Driver, where it's so much set to music. And I kind of think of this movie similarly. The way that the actors are moving, even when it's not necessarily like a big dance number is very musical. It's very balletic. It's gorgeous. So because the music is such an integral part to the storytelling, that's why I think it's a movie musical.
Right. I also think because our two front people here, Damien Chazelle, who directed, wrote this, and Justin Hurwitz, who composed, they're both musical fans. Damien Chazelle, actually a drummer. Me looking up to be like, was Whiplash inspired by Damien Chazelle? Is this an autobiographical movie?
Are you rushing or are you dragging? Okay. Exactly. Are you rushing or are you dragging? way I'm always rushing. Okay.
Yes. This was a passion project for both of them. They wrote this, I believe, in 2010, and we're at Harvard together, and we're trying to like shop this movie around. They did a short film, and then it ended up in like the right person's hands, and end of story. But both of them such big fans of musicals, and then pulling in, which I believe we said this on our Greatest Showman episode, you know, Pasek and Paul to come onto that team. And at the time, they were, I guess this was like around Dear Evan Hansen fame. Was it?
They came out the same year, right? So it was before... Oh, right.
Yeah. So they hadn't even really heard anything that they did.
I mean, Dogfight was like 2012-ish, right? And Christmas Story was 2013,
right?
If I'm wrong.
Yeah.
So they had been working and they had a song cycle, but their big project, their like kind of entry into the musical theater world was, they made a splash with Dear Evan Hansen, which came out the same year. This opened at TIFF in September 2016, and then Dear Evan Hansen opened on Broadway in October 2016. So the timing of both of these things. And then they won the Oscar for was City of Stars in February, and then they won the Tony for original score in June.
What a year.
So truly a year, 2016 to 2017, for Pasek and Paul. Like, what a splash to make, kind of, when you're so young and in your first year of being on the world stage. Really great stuff.
Well, something that I thought was super interesting when I was reading a couple articles about La La Land and from Justin Hurwitz specifically was that he said that because he's a composer, and this was the first time that Pasek and Paul had worked on a project where they were not composing. And something like A City of Stars, he spoke a lot about how that theme was written. The song was written. The composing was actually written. So to give them a song and be like, okay, go write lyrics, good luck. Like, that's difficult to do, especially when you're working with a composing team that is so used to like working on music and lyrics together, to be like, here's your song, go write a hit, thanks, see you later.
I mean, I don't write songs, but I would always imagine it's harder to have the music first and then put the like puzzle piece, the lyrics in, versus getting the lyrics and then working a melody around after. So I do think that the job they had is so hard, and I like that the lyrics in this, I find them very simple, like very almost pedestrian, if that makes sense. Like, in the same way that I find Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling to be passable singers but not amazing singers, it feels like the lyrics feel very human and feel that they are very much what would come to their minds and what they would just say naturally, very conversational, versus being overly flowery or over the top or like too musical theater lyrics.
Right. And to touch on that too, in that same interview, Justin Hurwitz had said that, you know, Pasek and Paul had come to Los Angeles and had, they sat around in an apartment together with the piano and started playing and singing City of Stars. And as soon as they said the lyrics, which are so simple and could literally just like, I could say that to you walking down the street, City of Stars, are you shining just for me? Justin Hurwitz was like, that's it. Like, this feels so right. This feels exactly what I needed it to be. Like, there's no one else that I wanted to do this except for you guys. And here we are with such a simple yet beautiful lyric and melody.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? Of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
So I think they got really lucky that it was like a perfect match all around. But yeah, it's just so interesting to me, as you said, like, I couldn't imagine being like, here's this instrumental piece, go right. That would seem
like,
so difficult.
Okay, how many syllables fit into this phrase? Okay, what's the rhyme? Like, does it go up at the end? Does it go down at the end? I can't imagine it would be so difficult.
Yeah.
Yes, like the song City of Stars. I mean, let's talk about the setting of this movie. The setting of this movie is Hollywood, La La Land. It's California.
This is a love letter to Los Angeles. Yes. Like, it really is. Yeah.
So this kind of brings me to, can you ever see this on stage?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to me is no. Because this movie is about movies. And so the format of it being a movie is like the only format that makes sense to me. It is a love letter to all these like classic movie musicals of the 50s and 60s, and mm-hmm. some coming a little bit later. But for the most part, those classic movie musicals, and kind of is inspired by them. And so the format is so important to the story that it's telling. And if you were to translate it from a movie to some other format, like on stage, I think you would miss so much of what makes it special in that it is like a love letter to movies.
I never thought about that. All I'm thinking about is I would love to see those two specifically up on stage giving us
stunt cast it. La La Land, but only stunt cast Emma and Ryan in it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's like 100% true. How can you portray something any different than a love letter to movies unless you were to completely flip it and have it be a love letter to musicals, but then it's a totally different story and you have to rewrite things.
And it's about Los Angeles, right? Like, to represent, and I mean, not many musicals have represented California or Los Angeles on stage, but Hollywood, La La Land, being the home of the entertainment industry, of the movie industry, mm-hmm. like that setting would be hard to translate to stage, just the way that it was done and with the cinematic tricks that they do.
Yeah.
Is hard. I mean, what was I going to say? They kind of did this, it's not the same, but in the musical Tootsie, right? The movie is about him trying to get cast on a soap opera, mm-hmm. right? But then when they put it on stage, is about him getting cast in a musical because the format just made more sense. And so, not the same, but kind of like a similar...
Same mentality. Yeah.
Yes. But I just can't imagine pulling it from the format of movie because it is, the story is so tied to the idea of movie to me.
They would also have to, I mean, it's happened before, but they would have to double the songs that are in it, yes. for sure. Cannot have a 7-song musical.
Six songs. Can you imagine?
But it would be nice. I think it would be nice as a, like, maybe 10-year anniversary concert at the Hollywood Bowl.
Where's your where's your intermission? After the planetarium, I think.
You know why?
Elephant love because, medley style.
Yes, but also, like, a very classic movie trick at the end of that scene, we fade in on the circle black, right?
It closes so you would off. Like have the you
yeah like, that would be so cool though if the curtains like close. You can't do that with curtains, but like if you could
it's like okay, like thinking of Moulin Rouge, right? Thinking of you do it with a spotlight, but thinking of Moulin Rouge, right, at the end of act one, it's Elephant Love Medley, which is kind of like them falling in love, which is takes place in this, it's the same emotional beat that's happening in La La Land in that moment at the planetarium, they're falling in love. And think about when they spin that elephant around and then like the sky is behind them. The Eiffel Tower swings out. Think about, you know, Mia and Sebastian like floating through the stars. Same kind of idea.
I mean, we did see someone on YouTube like edit together clips of like Inspiration. And that was very true to that. I think it is interesting to compare it to Moulin Rouge in a sense, because if we are to talk about a show that like worked perfectly adapted for stage, it is Moulin Rouge. You know, like that movie, when you watch that movie, you're like, I want to see that live on stage. I want to be in the Moulin Rouge with all of those people. So yeah, I agree in the sense that like, no, I don't know that it, maybe immersive in a movie theater, like The Flick. That's how we should do this.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking.
No, really, the only way to do this is the Hollywood Bowl with like scenes playing in the background. That's the only way that this needs to be
done. I think that would be like really, really
and a full
wonderful.
Orchestra. It would be awesome.
Oh my God. That would be, I mean, orchestra playing along.
I have an idea. Maybe we should contact Roy Thompson Hall. Roy Thompson Hall should do orchestra to La La Land. Because you know they do like Star Wars and Harry Potter. We need
it for La La
Land.
Play the movie and then you have the full orchestra do the score along with it. And then maybe you get some singers.
Ryan and Emma.
Yeah, Ryan and Emma come. Or like some other singers maybe to sing the music.
That would be great.
Magical.
I'm actually surprised that they haven't done something like that, because you know those orchestra movie marriage nights happen all over the world. Like I saw one in London. We saw Harry Potter at Royal Albert Hall. So, like, it would be awesome to, that was an experience, like, to do that, especially at Royal Albert Hall. But, like, I've never seen one at Roy Thomson Hall. I think it would be great.
Yeah, they do them all the time here. It's amazing.
Back to the music. Yeah, I think we had touched on it, like, very briefly. I wouldn't say that these songs are, like, Pasek and Paul's best, like, ones to write home about. I think that, as we had said, the simple melody, like, really works for this movie. I do love City of Stars, but I actually love the City of Stars that comes later in the movie that Sebastian and Mia sing together.
Yeah.
It's just, like, a happier tone
when
to that
song.
When they're
in love. It's when they're in love.
Yes, and then they, like, rip your heart out. But, like, in comparison to, you know, like, Sebastian walking around at night with the lamppost, which is such an iconic-looking scene in general, and the to contrast that with them just, like, sitting in his apartment at the piano, lovey-dovey, it's great. I love that.
Look in somebody's eyes to light up the skies, to open the world and send it really a voice that says I'll be here and you'll be all right. I don't care if I know just where I will go, 'cause all that I need's this crazy feeling I got tapped out of my heart. Think I want it to stay.
I feel like they filmed half this movie at Golden Hour. Like, so many scenes are right as the sun is setting. Speaking of that, like, A Lovely Night, this dance duet number.
The wow. First time I saw this scene, I was like, I love this movie. Like, I love this movie. It was the canary yellow dress. Like, we all know that is the iconic dress from that scene. But also, like, props to Ryan Gosling for his dancing in this scene. It is so, like, charming to watch him and Emma just, like, dance around the streets of Los Angeles.
The
wherever.
Tapping,
it's right by Griffith Park.
Is it? Is it right by Griffith Park? Is it?
Yeah. I couldn't
area?
Find it. I did do the, like, I mean, I didn't do the unofficial La La Land Los Angeles tour, but when I was not most recently in LA, but like a few years ago, my brothers and I went to Griffith Park and Observatory, and we did go into the room where that scene happens, which was just like cool. I believe City of Stars is on, like, I don't know if it's Santa Monica Pier, but it really looks like Santa Monica Pier, like, late at night. But we couldn't find the scene where they did Lovely Night. And I think it's a residential street. And I believe it's closed to the public unless, because there's a lot of, like, gated areas in LA. So I think you have to
It does look just kind of like a random street. And my guess, not my guess, but it is beautiful cinematic in that it looks over the city. But it's not, like, a special location in any other way.
It is right near the Griffith, like, Park and Observatory, but no, it is not, like, I don't think it's meant to be a spot.
No.
Although,
I wonder if
would be
someone
a great
on the team,
photo spot.
I wonder if someone on the movie team, like, lives near there, and they were looking for a spot.
Like, guys.
Like, so I have this place on my street.
Well, I just think, like, just to, like, dive into that scene in general, this is when Sebastian and Mia have met already, but they don't know that they've really met because Sebastian is playing Christmas music at J.K. Simmons doesn't have a character name that I am aware of in this movie, so at J.K. Simmons' restaurant. But he veers off and starts to play their theme, and then it goes into, like, the big, big theme that shows up again at the end of the movie, and he gets fired. And as Sebastian is leaving, Mia's about to say, like, I just need to tell you, like, I heard your song and whatever. And he, like, bumps into her and they walk by and then they meet each other again at this party. And, like, my favorite scene when Emma Stone is dancing to Iran at this, like, random party. It's so fun. And Ryan Gosling is just, like, playing sadly in the background. And then
I,
they,
I like...
when
you... This is very strong for Iran. The piano part is just one note the whole time. That's the piano. That's why it's funny. It's because it's just one note the whole time.
But then it also leads to the funniest part of that scene when they're like leaving together because they end up chatting at the party and he's like, what car did you is yours? And she's like, the Prius. And every single person there is driving a Prius. So we get to this amazing, beautiful scene because she's looking for her car. Mm-hmm. But, like, the tap dancing is so
even
good. And I think
before they get there, like, when they're flirting with each other and he's like, put it under your chin to see if you can find
it. And it works, like, obviously. I mean, we will talk about Ryan and Emma in a moment, but I feel like we also have to talk about Mandy Moore and her choreography specifically in this scene.
The tapping, it like, you just don't, they just don't make movies like this anymore. They just don't do scenes like this anymore. And no. To have them do this tap duet, it's very simple tapping, honestly. It's like not difficult at all. They're not doing complicated sounds. It's very just like one sound, I think. But I, like, it looks very effortless on them. Like, I think they worked really hard to make it look so simple.
We know Ryan
Ricard. I know.
We've
seen the
videos.
You worked
with Jenna Johnson.
Yes. Tara and I love Dancing with the Stars. We're always talking about Dancing with the Stars. And this movie was made around the time that Mandy Moore was kind of the resident choreographer for Dancing with the Stars. She would do the opening numbers every week. And they
I miss those opening numbers.
I know. I don't know if it's because of COVID this year. They had one this week.
I think they stopped them before that. Like, the big
Dancing with Stars
group opening numbers.
There was the golden era of Dancing with the Stars is in the past. It's not right now.
It's true.
There was,
guys, Zendaya was on Dancing with the Stars.
That
was
the golden era. Like, remember when they used to come down the stairs and it would be like, ba ba da ba 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 ba, and it would be like, welcome Zendaya and Val.
Or when, like, Julianne Hough was a dancer on Dancing with the Stars, was also golden age. Yeah.
Your partners, Elio Castroneves and Julianne Hough. Like, I miss that era. Anyway, this is not about Dancing with the Stars, but it was the era of Mandy Moore choreographing Dancing with the Stars. And she's not a ballroom choreographer. She is like a jazz contemporary choreographer. I've taken class from Mandy Moore many years ago.
Wow.
She's great. She's fun. I didn't know who she was at the time. A funny anecdote. I didn't know who she was at the time. So I saw on the faculty list of this dance workshop, it said Mandy Moore, and I was like,
you,
I didn't know. I thought it was singer Mandy Moore. I was like, I didn't know she was a dancer. That's so weird. And Mandy Moore, the choreographer's, like, Instagram handle or Twitter handle is nope, not her, meaning not the singer
the
Mandy Moore.
Yeah.
It's like the choreographer. Anyway.
Wait, why wouldn't you have been excited? I feel like that would have been during, like, Princess Diaries fame Mandy Moore.
I was excited. I was just very confused.
Oh, right. Okay. Got it.
It was like 2003, 2004, 2005 kind of time that I took class from Mandy Moore. Wow. That was a long time ago. So her choreography in this tap choreography, the way that they're like, it's very, sometimes it's just like their feet moving over, or just their shoulders, or the way that the one of them will move in one direction, the other person will move in the opposite direction, kind of like mirroring them. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's beautiful. It's like flirting in dance form.
It's stunning. And then to backpedal a bit, the song before the party is Someone in the Crowd. And I feel like that dance style, also amazing, especially when they get to that party. To me, it's very like Gatsby-esque. And
yes.
I love when they jump in the pool, and there's just like so many amazing things happening in that scene.
When she comes out of the bathroom and she's walking and everyone's kind of like frozen or like moving really slowly, and then it's like da da da.
The instrumental music in that scene is everything.
And then the guy jumps into the pool, which we were just watching that video. I didn't realize was a Boogie Nights reference. He jumps into the pool and you're kind of following him down and then up out of the pool, watching the dancers. And everyone's dancing around the pool and you're going, the camera's going underneath the pool and you're seeing people dance and above the pool and like spinning around. It's amazing. It's crazy.
And then to back it up even more, that opening number, right?
Perfect. Perfection. That is LA, right? LA traffic.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. The dancing is so good on top of the cars, the colors, like, it's just stunning.
Yes, yes. The most important job of an opening number, we've talked about it many times, is to set the tone for the rest of the movie, the rest of the show, and Another Day of Sun does that. You you don't have your main characters in it. You don't see them until right after that opening number. But you already know this is a story about, like, dreams. This is, mm-hmm. you get the vibrant colors and the sun. And, you know, it's, we're focusing on Mia and Sebastian, but they're just two people. And everyone around them is the same and has the same dreams and goals. And you're just hyper-focused on these two, but everyone is kind of in the same boat as them. And to see, their my favorite moment is the girl in the yellow dress there when she, like, leans back on the partition and her skirt kind of flies up. And then she gets on top of the thing and she raises her arms and everyone on the cars raises their arms in time with her. Mm-hmm. Like, so grand. It feels so big. The scope is amazing.
And then it just goes back to, as soon as that song ends, to, you know, like, everyday Los Angeles traffic as if nothing ever happened. Yes. I mean, the honk, also very iconic, I feel like, sets up Sebastian and Mia's relationship from the very moment that it happens until mm-hmm. the end of the movie. But just to, like, finish off the songs, one that does not have any choreo but is, like, randomly great is John Legend singing Start a Fire. A bit of a backstory for his character is that, like, him and Sebastian used to play jazz together in a band. And then, like, he went on tour and Sebastian didn't want to do, like, pop music jazz. He wanted to do, like, jazz.
So he wanted to be a real jazz musician.
Right. And then Mia basically was like, you need a job. So... I don't know, go and do this. And to watch the reaction on Mia's face when you see that song play for the first time and she's like, this is literally, like, this is not what you want to do. You want to open up your own jazz club and here you are performing with, like, pop jazz icon John Legend, whatever that his character's name is. And, yeah, it's just, like, I think it's interesting to add a style of a song like that because it doesn't quite fit in this movie, but at the same time, fits perfectly because it is so different. I don't really know how to describe it, but I love the song.
You know, we talk about this John Legend song, Start a Fire, but there was a little bit of a controversy. And it's what I understand, the idea that this movie is like white-splaining jazz to the audience. Our main character of Sebastian is always talking about his love of jazz and his love of jazz performers and musicians. But so many of those jazz performers and musicians were Black people. And it's very much being presented through a white lens in this movie. And it's a big critique of this movie that he is considered like an expert, but we are kind of erasing the culture that created jazz. It does not inhibit my enjoyment of the movie, but it is, like, I can imagine slightly frustrating for Black people and Black jazz musicians to see that their contribution is so diminished in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I had read an article yesterday that said, you know, there are so many historical problems with the music in this movie, but why do we love it so much? And you know what? Passing on Paul Wright, a catchy tune, and Justin Hurwitz obviously, like, I would assume that he is also a big jazz fan to be able to create and compose music like that, but definitely can understand all of that criticism. And I don't know, I think they might have needed like a character for Sebastian to talk to maybe have us understand more of like where he found his love of jazz music, because I do think that that's a part of the movie that might be missing.
It's true. The movie's so focused on these two characters, and any other character that comes in is barely there, you know?
Yeah, like his sister, right? His sister is there for like a moment.
She was doing press for this movie, and after I saw the movie, I was like, this girl has 7 lines.
She didn't need to be doing interviews.
You don't need to fly her out to do interviews for this movie. She's not in the movie, okay? It's so focused on these two characters and their relationship to each other. Everyone else is kind of periphery. So it is a choice to not have any other main characters, but it is to kind of, it makes it seem like these characters live in a very, very insular world and they're not mm-hmm. really concerned with the world going on around them. Right. Which might be on purpose, but it is kind of, especially when you're dealing with jazz music, which is so influenced and created by Black people, to not have them really.
Well, the history is there for us, yeah. right? Like, we know that. We know of, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, the idea is, I guess, it is meant to contrast the rest of the music in the movie because we're meant to think that this song is very out of character for Ryan Gosling's character Sebastian to be performing, to be participating in. And when Mia sees him performing that, everyone else is loving it, but she's doesn't like it and she's disappointed because it's not him. The him that mm-hmm. she's gotten to know and that we've gotten to know is this other style of music that's been playing throughout the movie. And then to see him do that.
Yeah, he's playing on a synth, right? Like, he's using a synthesizer.
Yeah, it's not even a real piano. And yeah, like, she's so surprised to see him do that. But then also he did it, he thinks, for her, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I love the demise of their relationship scene when she says to him, like, do you even like the music you're playing? And he's like, do you like the music I'm playing? She says yes immediately, but, like, we all know he doesn't like what he's playing. He's just doing it because he thinks that she asked him to get a job and he needs to support
He overheard the phone call with her mother, right? Yeah, it's hard because he's doing it for her, but she, like, wants him to be happy and doesn't think that he's happy doing this. But I also think it's, like, very unfair of her to say that to him. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's very complicated. I don't know. I like the demise of the relationship because I feel like it's complicated in the right way and not, like, overwrought unintentionally.
Yes, I agree. I mean, spoiler for anyone that hasn't seen La La Land, we do not have, I mean, some would argue maybe it is a happy ending. Again, we'll talk about the ending in a little bit, but they obviously break up, which, like, devastating. The demise of the relationship is devastating, but especially that scene when Sebastian does not show up to her one woman play.
Because he's doing a photo shoot.
For John Legend. But that's when they essentially break up and she goes back home. And then, do we know the time that's passed when he comes to see her? I feel like it's been a little bit of time. It's not like the next day.
No, I don't think it's, is it another season?
It might be another season, which is something that, again, I realized it when I saw it, but it's been a while since I've last watched this. This whole movie is told through the seasons, their relationship through the seasons, which I think is brilliant. Like, it's so smart to tell a love story that way.
The seasons of love.
Seasons. Exactly. But he gets her, or he doesn't get her. They get a call that some famous woman was in the audience and would love for Mia to audition for her movie, which is when we get the song The Audition. Audition, which I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that one was sung live and everything else was not.
I know Audition was sung live because they had her treat it like a monologue and she had an earpiece and Justin Hurwitz was playing but following along with what she was doing.
Yes, that's amazing.
It is amazing. Well, because it allows her to, like, act in the moment. Something like A Lovely Night, you know, you have to have these, like, very specific choreography beats. And a lot of that is dancing and instrumental anyway. But even if they did sing live, they're moving so much that you don't necessarily, it probably would sound horrible.
Well, I also
and to
think
mic
that,
it, to, like, to get the sounds from their voice.
True.
Horrible.
I just don't think that they would have got the performance that they wanted from Emma if she didn't sing it live. I'm sure they did it. I would love to see the outtakes of that to see how many different ways that she did it.
That's true.
Because, like, that is, I said this again, like, before we started recording, but, like, to me, this is her star-making role. And I think a lot of people talked about that scene after this movie came out to be like, hello, Emma Stone. Like, have you been everything after this?
And here's to the fools who dream, crazy as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that break. Here's to the mess we make.
It's just 5 minutes on her face, basically.
Yeah.
just focused. I mean, normally she has such a, she always has such an expressive face and expressive eyebrows and eyes, but this movie spends so much time just like zoomed in on her face and her expressions and her acting that we really get to see what she can do. And that song is kind of the pinnacle moment of it.
I mean, I think it's interesting to bring up now that, you know, it was not scheduled to be a Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone movie. The original proposition for La La Land was Miles Teller and Emma Watson. Now, we know Miles Teller was in a Damien Chazelle movie. He was in Whiplash. Again, if no one has seen Whiplash, like, go watch that. Like, that
we
is...
We love Whiplash. Right, Whiplash was the same year as Birdman, which we were just talking about earlier, right? Like,
yes,
a few years earlier, Birdman, which has Emma Stone in it. So, yeah, just a...
Yeah,
an interesting
so,
fact.
Right, and Emma Watson dropped out because she was doing Beauty and the Beast, and I believe that Justin Hurwitz and Damien Chazelle went to go see Emma Stone do Cabaret, because it was also kind of around that time, live, with, was what's his name doing it at that time too? Oh my God,
Alan
what
Cumming?
Is his name? Yeah, was she doing it with him?
Yeah, Alan Cumming did the whole run.
Yeah, so they had seen her in that. And then Ryan Gosling also supposed to be in Beauty and the Beast, and then he dropped out to do La La Land, but there was some scheduling conflicts because of The Big Short. Now, if you have not seen Crazy Stupid Love, what are you doing, first of all? But that is the movie where we all fell in love with Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone. So to see them reunite in this way, I feel like was one, fan service, and two, everything that I ever wanted.
I think the fact that they cast a pair of actors who had worked together multiple times before is another way that this movie references like old Hollywood movies, because that was a very common thing to have. I don't even know who anymore, but they would have the same, you know, pairing of actors, of an actor and an actress who would star in love stories over and over and over again, back to like the 30s and 40s. And these movie musicals who like Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, and they would have the actresses they would always pair with. So for Ryan and Emma, their casting even more harkens back to that era of movie making. And I think it just adds an extra element. Not only is the movie itself, but the casting of the movie, everything about the movie is like a throwback. And when you have actors who've worked together before, working together on another project, it brings a history to the project and like a deepened understanding for the audience, not even for their performers, but for the audience. You already have a history with their chemistry that you can bring to the movie that like adds an extra element.
I mean, I was going to say, first of all, that's a great point. I never thought about how they probably thought about casting them. I mean, maybe they did.
They
maybe
like wanted a
blessing
pair.
In disguise. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't, well,
like Miles Teller and Emma Watson were not a pair, but I wonder if a part of that was like, oh, we can get this pair of actors who have singing and dancing experience. Because I don't know if we know this, but Emma Stone's like first foray was like a Find the Next Partridge Family reality show on
and
VH1
Ryan Gosling was a Mickey Mouse,
was the Mickey Mouse Club, right? So yeah. You know that these people can sing. Yeah, it like the
so
like,
interesting.
The series of events that brought them into this movie were...
Well, also because it wasn't like... This was not a movie that, you know, a lot of people were throwing money at. They tried to get this movie up on its feet for a really long time and then ended up bringing this project to both of them, and they were both really interested. And I agree. I'm not sure that either, maybe Emma Stone, I don't know that Ryan Gosling would have signed on this with someone that he maybe hadn't worked on previously with, because I do think that that pre-established connection is so important to these characters specifically. And we all know the chemistry that the two of them have is like... next level. It is so great, and I do think that that is a reason that this movie in my eyes is great and like super successful. A lot of that is owed to their performances together, individually, whatever, but together it's like they're not even acting. When you see like me and Sebastian in a scene together, like that is the relationship. There it's not like, even though it's Ryan and Emma, it's also not Ryan and Emma. I just like love watching them together, and to me this was a perfect match for this movie and for this story.
Yeah. I don't know if you could have found two better stars for the movie.
No.
I want them to work together again. Ryan and Emma.
We all want them to work together again. Like, everything that they do
find
together,
something.
I'm like, wow, when's the next movie? I know.
Find something good.
Well, especially
it has to
because,
be good.
Like,
it has to be good.
Ryan Gosling is someone who is so private.
So we never hear about him unless he's like doing a movie. And even then, yeah. he doesn't really do a lot of like press for movies. He's just like a good Canadian boy with his taking care of his family.
Even he as an actor is kind of a throwback. The way he has like changed his voice to make him sound like he's from New York, even though he's from Canada. You know what yeah. I mean? Like,
wow, sorry. As you're saying this, I'm like, Ryan wouldn't have been with anyone else. What if Rachel McAdams was signed on to do this movie? One, she wouldn't because she can't sing. But two, the Notebook reunion that we all needed.
Oh my God, can you imagine? That would be crazy.
We'd be devastated, crying.
It would be amazing. Oh.
Steph, I know you want to talk about the movie references, so
yes,
go for
it. So this movie, it's very obviously a reference to Damien Chazelle's favorite movie that he has stated, which is The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. I've talked about it like briefly on the podcast before, but it is a French movie from the 1960s, directed by Jacques Demy, which I think, the way I was talking about the same kind of core story that this movie has, it's a very similar core story. Two people fall in love and then conflict happens and they have to separate and be apart. And they're star-crossed lovers. And then similar to the way that La La Land ends with Sebastian and Mia seeing each other one last time and kind of like to accomplish their dreams or to have the life that they always wanted, they can't be together, but like seeing that they are happy or satisfied or living their dream is kind of similarly to the way that The Umbrellas of Cherbourg ends, where our characters, Genevieve and Guy, see each other one last time and they just like acknowledge that they're living the life that they had told each other they dreamed of, and then they separate and never see each other again. And the colors of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg are mm-hmm. very like very clearly a referenced in La La Land. The ending Dream Ballet, I mean, that Dream Ballet references many other movies and movie musicals, but The Umbrellas of Cherbourg as well. It's just the way that the score is like so sweeping through the entire movie. The theme, their like love theme, is very, very similar and is a very clear reference. And I love that movie, and it's very, the homage to it that La La Land has is so, so wonderful. And I think Damien Chazelle like honors that kind of like style of movie, and specifically that movie, which he said is his favorite movie, so well.
Mm-hmm. I loved reading an article where they said that Damien Chazelle would host like movie nights of old Hollywood movies to get everyone in the zone of like, this is the type of stuff that we're creating here, and I want you to watch the best of the best. When I was watching mm-hmm. this most recently, because I don't think I had seen this since I had seen An American in Paris on stage, that Dream Ballet to me is like full on inspired by An American in Paris. You know, the way that, especially when they go to Paris in that Dream Ballet, and the artwork, the way that everything looks is almost like painted comic book style, but not really comic book style.
It's like impressionism,
very cool.
Like Van Gogh yeah. kind of impressionism, yeah. Like light. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And it's 15 minutes of like silence, not silence, music.
Just
no
music,
dialogue.
But no words. The story told entirely through movement and music.
Which is exactly the same as An American in Paris, although I think the Dream Ballet in that is like 35 minutes with no dialogue.
I think
no
the one in
La La
Land is about 8 minutes. The La La Land one is yeah. like 8-ish minutes. So the American in Paris one is definitely much longer. Yeah. Other movies that it references, like Funny Face, when she's in front of the Arc de Triomphe, they bring the balloons to her. Singing in the Rain. There's so much Singing in the Rain in this movie, but a lot of it in that Dream Ballet, when there's a big dance number, I feel like when it's all red around and Emma Stone is in purple, yes. that is very Singing in the Rain to me.
Even West Side Story, right?
Right, when she's like getting ready
with the friends.
Mm-hmm. Someone in the crowd, like West Side Story to I'll Feel Pretty. There are so many things that you watch and you're like, this picture that they've created looks so familiar to me. It's evoking something and you can't quite place it, but mm-hmm. it evokes like nostalgia. And that Dream Ballet is kind of the huge, like the biggest moment of it, because it is created to evoke that kind of nostalgia. but it's peppered throughout the entire movie.
Before we talk about the end of this movie, because I think the end of this movie is very important, I do want to talk about award season, because I love talking about award season.
The most dramatic Oscars of all time.
Well, but before we get to the Oscars, so La La Land was a record-breaking 7 awards from its 7 nominations at the Golden Globe Awards that year. It received 11 nominations at the BAFTA Awards that year, and it won 5, including Best Film. And then it also received a record-tying 14 nominations at the 89th Annual Academy Awards, winning in 6 categories, maybe 7 if you watch the broadcast that night, including Best Actress for Emma Stone, Best Director for Damien Chazelle, who was the youngest winner in the category at 32 years old. Okay, let's set the scene of the Oscars night. Steph, I learned, was in Iceland, so she did not even see it.
So the time difference is different. It's a time difference, obviously. I think it's 4 hours. So I was asleep when this was happening on a couch, too. We're staying at Airbnb in Iceland. And I woke up to like 8 million notifications on my phone. And one of them was like my friend being like, I can't believe Steph is missing this.
So I was working my morning hours during that time. And I mean, every award show runs overtime. Like, you know, it says it's going to end at 11 yeah. o'clock, but it didn't. But this one really ran overtime because they actually messed up. So Warren Beatty and I don't know who it was. Was it Jane Fonda?
No, Jane Fonda would never do that to us.
I just thought because, like, you know, two classic
Faye actors. Dunaway. It was Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway. Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway come out to... present Best Picture. Wait, Steph, since you have the Wikipedia up, what else was in the running that year?
So the winner was obviously Moonlight.
Moonlight.
But the other nominees were Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, Lion, and Manchester by the Sea. Wow, this was a good year.
Lion,
amazing.
Love Lion.
Manchester by the Sea, amazing. Hidden Figures, great. I never saw Arrival, but I heard it was fantastic. Moonlight, obviously the Best Picture winner, and La La Land, like, great movies.
So what happened was Academy Awards always ends with Best Picture, and I think if you win Best Director, the chances of Best Picture are pretty high. So knowing that Damien Chazelle had won for Best Director, I think everyone there was like, well, you know, it's going to be La La Land. So Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway come out and they announce that La La Land has won Best Picture. La La Land has not won Best Picture. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Yet they let every single person from the crew of La La Land walk on the stage and they stood there for what I want to say was at least 2 minutes.
A long time. The problem with this is that the first person giving a speech, I get it. I understand. You thought you won. You're giving a speech. Like, by the time the third person's up there giving a speech, someone needs to stop it right away. You're right. But the thing is, no one knows except for the accountants, right? And so...
Where were the accountants?
It took time. The problem was one of them was like faffing about backstage and gave the wrong envelope. So it took time to figure out what was going on. And Jimmy Kimmel is just like, I don't know. So then by the time the third person from La La Land is speaking, and then he says it to Mike at the end of his speech, we didn't even win. Who was the producer who went up and he was like, we didn't win. Moonlight won. But he's like holding up the card. Who was that?
Not Mark Platt, I can tell you that.
No, it was not Mark Platt. It was like a younger producer. I don't remember his name. And then Moonlight won. And then there's like the picture of the audience, which looks like a Renaissance painting of the celebrities just being like in shock. It's like Busy Phillips, Meryl Streep, Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, just absolutely in shock.
No one could sleep after that. I think I was up for like 2 hours after that, just like on Twitter, reading about all of the reactions. Because first of all, how terrible for La La Land, but also how terrible for Moonlight. They have to go up after that and give a speech? What?
Especially, you know, Moonlight is a very unique Best Picture winner. You know, a story about Black people, about queer people. And so them winning Best Picture was kind of a milestone moment. And now that the conversation about them winning Best Picture is so much about this other movie that we've already talked about white splains jazz to black people. It's very frustrating for Moonlight. It's very frustrating.
Warren Beatty never to present an award ever again.
There, Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty.
Anyway, I mean, I will say, I had seen like a few movies in that list that year. In my heart, La La Land was the best picture winner. To me, it is the best movie of that bunch. Let's talk about the end. But to get to the end of that movie, I do think it's important to talk about the film style, which I briefly touched on. So the film style starts right off the top when we are in the traffic scene. We are with Mia in the car, who is being honked at by said person. And she's like reading her lines for an audition while stuck in traffic. Great.
It's
and
unsafe.
Then we go through Mia's journey a bit. And then it switches. I don't remember
that's
where it
true.
Switches.
I forgot.
I literally watched this yesterday.
It's at the moment where Sebastian like hits her at the piano bar
right,
that he's just been
restaurant.
Fired from, which we don't know he's just been fired at that point. He just walks right past her. And then we jump all the way back to him in the car and we see the same thing
honking
from his perspective.
At her. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the most like blatant switch in perspectives. It does happen from time to time as the movie goes on. And then obviously once they meet and they're in a relationship, we're with them together. So there's not really a need to switch perspectives until we get to the end. So when we get to the end, it is Mia books this big movie and it's in France, but before she books that, you know, they realize that yes, they had broken up before he drove her to the audition, but they end with like, I will always love you, I'll love you forever, you were my first love, like that sort of thing. And then they like go their separate ways happily. She does this movie, we see like her sort of lifestyle, she's like made it very big, and then we have a 5-year time jump, which is all like sort of happening in this dream ballet sequence. She's married with a kid and she goes on a date.
They're staying at the Chateau Marmont. They're living, she's living at the Chateau Marmont. I love that. It's like so Hollywood, you know? Of course she's living at the Chateau Marmont.
And also one of the scenes that I love, Mia in the beginning of this movie works at the coffee shop on a lot. I assume it's like a Warner Brothers lot, whatever. And she goes back to that coffee shop and orders coffee and they are big fans of her, which is like the complete opposite of how it started. She was big fans of whoever would walk in. Anyway, they end up, her and her husband end up going out for dinner.
And she tips really nicely, if I remember.
She does.
Yeah.
They're like stuck in traffic, again, very much like the beginning, on an LA freeway. And instead of like waiting, she's like, just pull off here and we'll go to a restaurant somewhere. So then they go to this restaurant and then he hears jazz music playing, her husband. And he's like, let's go check this out. And I feel like when I first saw this, I was like, oh my God, like it has to be his club. Like who else's club is this going to be?
That's movies, you know, that's movie magic. Of course she's going to walk into, of all the gin joints in the world, you had to walk into mine, you know?
Exactly. So they walk down the stairs, you don't see anything. There's just like a neon arrow. And I think before this, like, not in the dream sequence, we see, like, Ryan Gosling or Sebastian, like, getting ready for the opening night. I guess it's opening night of his club. And she walks down and she sees the sign Seb with
that
the
music.
She designed. Seb with the music note.
That she designed for
him. Because he was stupidly going to call his jazz club Chicken on a Stick. And she just stands there for a moment, realizing, you know, they're about to see each other for the first time in 5 years. And her husband comes and is like, are you okay? Do you want to come in? So they go in, they sit down, and they listen to the jazz play, which is not Sebastian at this point. And then he comes out, and he sees her. They lock eyes. And I'm crying in the theater. And there's this moment of, like, what's going to happen here? And he says, welcome to Seb's, sits down at the piano, and plays their theme. And then we switch perspectives, or do we switch perspectives?
Right. So this is the debate, like, this dream ballet, whose perspective is it from? Is it from Mia's? Is it from Sebastian's? Or is it, like, kind of a combination of their
perspectives? Because we see,
perspective.
Like, in the dream ballet, they end up together. They have a kid together. Like, he does not open the club. We see the exact same scene play out.
When John Legend goes to see him, he says, no, thank you.
That's the best part.
When he comes up, like, shrugs and then just walks away. It's so funny. It's comedy. It's a comedy. Which is why I think it's Seb's perspective, because I think he sees that as, like, a turning point. And if he hadn't gone with that band, which is what he thought she wanted, their life he would be with her still, and he would have just spent his life supporting her, you know, as shown when she's doing the audition scene in the silhouette and he's just like applauding in the waiting room. You know, in his perspective, that was a moment where he went left when he should have gone right. And if he'd gone right, their lives would be completely different. So that's why I think it's from his perspective.
Wow, I didn't think we'd agree on this, but I also think that it's from his perspective. That's the life that he wanted. And it's devastating, but that's the life that he wanted with her. He wanted, I don't know that he wanted to, like, not in a bad way, like, ride her coattails. I think he did want to open his own club and in this dream ballet. Mm-hmm. Like, no, he does not. They end up going to
but
a club
he would
together.
Have given it up to, like, be with her.
Yes. And while watching it, like, he's not unhappy. He is happy in that relationship. You know, they have a son, which is so interesting because in her own life, she has a daughter. Like, it's very different, which is why I don't know. I think for a moment I was like, I think this could be a combination of both of them fantasizing what their lives could be like together. But ultimately, I do think that it is his perspective. And I think we sort of confirm that at the end when we are back in present day and her husband turns to her and says, like, do you want to stay for another? And she says no, and they leave. But then we get that moment again where they lock eyes and they sort of smile and nod at each other as if, like, I'm okay, you're okay.
Yeah.
You can go on. Like, and again, me in tears, like, in the theater.
I know. Oh, my God. I cried so much watching this. Like, just an acknowledgement of, like, how much they meant to each other, but also an acknowledgement, like, our lives are, like, meant to be separate.
Yeah. Like, they cross paths at the right time, but also maybe the wrong time. Like, I mean, as a fan of both of them, and I think as a fan of the movie, there's always a part of you. I know you love open-ended ending.
This is the kind of ending that I do love.
But, like, I secretly wanted them to end up together. And I think many people... I remember,
but I
actually...
think this makes a more interesting movie, you know?
Well, for sure. Yes, it does. But I remember seeing this movie with my parents and my brother the second time. My dad, big Ryan Gosling, Emma Stone fan. When they did not end up together and the movie ended, he turned to us and he was like, that's it? Like, what? How could they not end up together? They were perfect for each other, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, it's devastating to not see, especially because we got a glimpse of what their life could have been. And although great for her, maybe not so great for him, even though he would have sacrificed it because he loved her, he got to do what he wanted to do. And there's always a piece of her with him in the name of his club. Like, she named that for him. So he'll never forget her. He'll love her forever.
Like, the people that you meet in your life, even if you don't know them for the rest of your life, will, like, influence you. And that's, like, another thing. The movie is told in seasons, right? In four seasons. And then this, like, 5 years in the future. And it's, like, they loved each other for a season. And then they went their separate ways. But that doesn't mean that their love, like, wasn't important or didn't, like, influence the rest of their lives. Wow, crying here talking about the ending of La La Land. Like, get a grip.
It's the acting, I'm telling you. The two of them together just really, like, make you feel it for real. I don't know that again, like I said this earlier, but I don't know that we could have created this movie magic with anybody else. I'm sure it would have come close, but not this close.
No, I think the casting of this is, like, really pivotal in the success of this movie. Both of them have, like, these, like, faces that you could just read a million emotions on. Like, Emma Stone's face, just her eyebrow work. So good. Just, like, what she's doing with the brows. They're, like, very dark in this movie, I find.
They
it's
are
a very
dark.
Interesting look on her.
And I mean, Ryan Gosling's face just fades.
What a face. So, what a face, Ryan.
Yeah.
Should we rate the movie?
We should rate it.
Okay.
Okay.
This is, like, obviously our personal ratings. My rating scale is going to be Flock of Seagulls songs. So out of 5 Flock of Seagulls songs, I give it a 5, like, love this movie. 5 out of 5 Flock of Seagulls songs. I ran 5 times in a row in honor of me.
Yeah, love it. My metric is Ryan Gosling biting his lip, wearing sunglasses and a baseball hat at the photo shoot.
Watch us on YouTube and you'll see that right here. And I am also giving this a 5 out of 5. I adore this movie. I could watch it over and over and over again. And I think what's so great about that is that everything that they took from the classics, they've made a classic themselves without probably even trying to. This movie, to me, is like so above movies that I have seen in the last 5 years, 10 years. And yeah, I wish that they would make movies like this more, because it's just so great to see old Hollywood set in modern day. And yeah, I love this movie and I'll never stop talking about it. So. But I guess that is our full thoughts and feelings on La La Land. If you have seen La La Land, we would love to hear from you. And with that being said, it's now time for our obsession of the week.
Okay, so my obsession of the week is my family recently watched the first season of the television show Ted Lasso. Guys, it was great.
Have you seen it, Steph? I can't believe you didn't tell me this.
Sorry. Did I not tell you?
No, I have seen this. Everyone in my family has watched this but me.
You should. It's really fun. It's really good. We bought my dad an iPad for his birthday. So we have Apple TV for 3 months. So we're just like, what can we watch on Apple TV?
Isn't it a year? I feel like it's a year.
I'll confer with dad because he is the
Apple
owner
if
of the
you're
iPad.
Listening.
Give us a year.
It should be a year.
Come on. So yeah, we watched all of season one of Ted Lasso, and at the end of the final episode of the season finale, a song is played that is You'll Never Walk Alone from the musical Carousel, covered by Marcus Mumford. And this song kind of has become a football anthem, football in the UK sense, not in the American
soccer.
Sense. A football anthem in the UK for Liverpool FC, and it's kind of been used in the Premier League a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand why. And and so at the end of season one of Ted Lasso, there's kind of, it's an emotional 5 minute scene.
No
at the
spoilers.
End. No spoilers. All I know is that I love Roy Kent, and that's all. But there is this emotional scene, and it's scored by this version of You'll Never Walk Alone by Marcus Mumford, and it sounds gorgeous. And when I was listening to it, I was like, I know this song. This song is from a musical. And there's a few musical references peppered throughout the series, but this was kind of the most blatant, this use of You'll Never Walk Alone at the end. And I think it's just a really, really pretty version. I love Marcus Mumford and Mumford and Sons, and so his cover of that song is really wonderful, and it's used to great effect in this scene.
With hope in your heart, and you'll
my obsession this week, I am back to work, which means I am back in the car listening to whatever I can listen to on my commute in. And I recently, I had listened to it before, but I listened to it again. It is the Cut Songs album from Waitress, What's Not Inside. This album is like all Sarah Bareilles. It's very good. However, I will say that my obsession this week is actually, again, from this album, but it's Shoshana Bean singing Door Number 3 from this What's Not Inside album. And I don't know that we talked about Door Number 3 on our Waitress episode. I feel like we didn't.
No, because it turned into What Baking Can
what
Do,
Baking
right?
Can do.
Like,
yeah.
Door Number 3 is kind of the more muted, more subtle version of What Baking
yeah.
Can Do.
Well, what's interesting is that Door Number 3 existed on the original Waitress concept album, which I don't even know what it was called, the original like Sarah album.
I think it's called What's Inside.
What's Inside?
The Songs of
yeah.
Waitress.
Yeah. So I had listened to it there, and I remember that I had listened to that song so much, and you were like, but have you listened to What Baking Can Do? Because that
exactly.
is the superior version of that
exactly.
song.
Exactly.
Which
it, had,
it
it's
is.
It's that same like, boom,
yeah. Exactly. But one,
you know, I love Shoshana Bean. I love her voice. And she is doing some, like, amazing, like, mixing on this track. She, like, flips into her head voice, and it's, like, the most beautiful sounding thing ever. Rush, I gotta make a change or else I know.
I've already walked through. I wanna see what's behind door number three.
But what I love about this is that I watched the, it was on the reopening night of Waitress on Broadway. It was like all of the Jennas except for Sarah Bareilles, because obviously she was busy, on Stars in the House, and they were all talking about this song specifically. And Jesse Mueller said that door number three was in ART version of Waitress when she right. did it, and it was cut because What Bacon Can Do was like being written during that process. But she was like, thank God, because that song is so hard to sing. And they were like, only you, Shoshana, can sing this. Like, you're the only person that can sing this song the way that it should be sung. And Sarah, obviously. But mm-hmm. I just think sometimes it's so interesting. And I think that more shows should release their cut songs so that you can hear what the final product ended up being. Mm-hmm. And this is a great example of it. It's a great song. It's actually like a really good song to listen to on its own, because I don't think you need the full context of the plot of Waitress to enjoy it. And also, Shoshana sounds amazing. So her version is my obsession this week. But yeah, like, musicals, give us more cut songs. I'm really interested in this. I know Hamilton did it most recently, I guess. But
I think sometimes the magic is left on the floor. It's yes. true. Like, sometimes a song is amazing but doesn't serve the story or the moment, or something else fits better. I think one day we'll do an episode talking about cut songs.
Do you think we could do a full episode, though? Because I don't know that there's that many to speak on.
I think we'd have to do a lot of research, but yeah, I do think there's a lot there, because we're thinking of just recent musicals that we're familiar with, you know, the Jeremy Hansen album, the Hamilton album,
right.
this Waitress album. But, you know,
I think
there's many, many cut songs, like trunk also, songs from...
Yes. Also, recently, Once on This Island, like, released their cut songs, too. So,
oh, did they?
There is some, that's like, cool songs out there. So, if you're ever looking for stuff, I know, like, Playbill puts out, they have, actually, Playbill's a really good resource for that stuff. They have, like, what's streaming, and they put up all of their stuff and the dates that it's coming out. So, it is interesting to check that stuff out. But the entire album, the What's Not Inside, there's also a cut Dr. Pometer song that on Waitress's YouTube channel, Jeremy Jordan sings, really good. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out there, and yeah, that wraps up our obsessions and also our thoughts on La La Land. So, as I said, if you have seen La La Land, please let us know. And also, I mean, we didn't mean for this to be the year of the movie musical, but it definitely has turned into the year of the movie musical, because our for next sure. episode is Tick, Tick, Boom. And that is something that I am so excited to
I'm
see.
I'm excited. Some yeah. old musicals, some new musicals. Well, talking about Tick, Tick, Boom... That was a one-person show, and they added some kind of, like, songs that weren't originally in it to mm-hmm. this movie. Some cut songs, if you will. Some yes. trunk songs of Jonathan Larson. They exactly. put them back in to fill it out to make a whole movie. So sometimes yeah. they get a second life.
It's true. But yeah, it's been a super exciting year of movie musicals. And as always, if there's a movie musical that you would like us to talk about, you can let us know. And you can do that by following us on Instagram and Twitter at @OffToBWayPodcast with the number 2.
And you can listen to us anywhere podcasts are found, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify and anywhere else. And you can subscribe to us on YouTube, where we'd love it if you would subscribe and leave us a comment.
And we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.